And good morning here on the Fuzzy Logic Science Show on 2XX. Thank you, Bruce, for Irish voice this morning. Now we he's giving a little bow in the studio here for us all. Now, we've had some hot days here in Canberra over the last week or so, and imagine this situation. It's hot. There's a house on fire. You're a fireman. You're wearing heavy gear. You're running around and you're trying to save the people and do what you can to save the property in the house. It's a hazardous, perilous situation, and your enemy, amongst other things, is heat. Now, our guest today on Fuzzy Logic is Dr. Anthony Walker, and he's a thermal physiologist from the University of Canberra, and he works with the ACT Fire Service. Good morning, Anthony.
Good morning, Rod.
Anthony, we've had a long conversation over coffee this morning, and you clearly have a strong passion and a very deep interest in the question of fire and heat and how people cope in this situation. What is it that got you involved? What got you interested in this story?
Well, as I said, I've been an urban firefighter for 10 years, and what my background is actually in sports science. And what appeared to be the rules for how we function in the heat in a sporting environment don't tend to work in our work context. What really triggered me, we had a high-speed rollover out on Coringa Drive. Took 2.5 hour extrication of a couple of people. And at the time I was running marathons, so I had high VO2, low body fat, which is what we think should make you good. However, I suffered quite significantly from heat illness during that event and had to move off the fire ground a number of times. Whereas the older guys who probably in less ideal physical condition continued to work, and that made no sense to me. So I then thought, well, let's try and work out exactly what it is in our environment that changes the rules so significantly.
Okay, so tell me a bit more about that situation. Do you now have a view as to why that happened? What was it that made you cope with the heat differently to the others?
Well, I think what we now, or what my thoughts are now, is that, again, when we think about particularly endurance athletes, we think of the Africans, the small, 40, 50 kilo guys who are very light. That works very well in an environment where you need to dissipate heat through sweat and the air. Unfortunately, modern firefighting equipment is heavy, has within it a moisture membrane to protect us from steam and chemicals. And what that does is that means that those people who are smaller and lighter are probably sustaining a lot more heat through having to carry a lot of gear and just not being able to get rid of that. So the bigger guys are actually producing, to do the same amount of work, they're working less hard than the smaller guys, and then therefore they're producing less heat.
Now, you went for a jog this morning. In fact, we met for coffee before the show, and you've done 20 kilometres already today, and you've downed a whole bottle of water already. So you're going to lose a lot of water. I guess that's fairly obvious. But how much would you lose?
But depending upon, I mean, every single person is different, so there's no actual number. But we know that athletes in particular can sweat up to about 3.5 litres an hour. So if you're, say, a 100-kilo person, you go for a run at 100 and you come back at 96, 97 kilos after 1 hour. The big problem is from there that our body can only empty about 1 to 1.5 litres out of our stomach, which means that over time you're going to sustain big amounts of dehydration over time if you're not replacing that water.
Are you breathing that water out and you're sweating it at both, I presume?
Yeah, the main way our body actually dissipates heat is through evaporation of sweat from your skin. So, and again, depending upon what the actual environment is and how hard you're working will dictate exactly how much sweat you are producing and how much is going off you.
So tell me a bit more about that car rollover situation. What was the outcome? What was it like to be there at that time?
It was actually, it's probably 3 or 4 years ago now, so it was what we call a red day in terms of our bushfire preparedness. So it was about a 38, 39 degree day, about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. It was a high-speed rollover with a couple of elderly people in it. And as I said, it took a long time. The car was on its side in a ditch. And just the actual physical extrication of taking a roof off, just the day-to-day things we do, made that incredibly difficult in that heat and in that environment, particularly wearing the PPE we were.
Right, because the ACT Fire Service don't just attend fires, they do other emergency services type work, such as extractions in a car, rollover situation, is that right?
Yeah, very much so. We focus on how much firefighting we actually do, which in the modern world, it's actually a lot, getting less and less of our work. However, we are the primary rescue agency in the ACT for MVAs, so motor vehicle accidents, vertical rescues, urban search and rescue. So whenever we have earthquakes, we deploy teams in interstate and also overseas. Hazardous materials, so in the chem suits whenever we had the white powder incidents. So our job is actually getting much broader. So our people here in Canberra, and again, because we're such a small fire service, we have to do everything. We have to become masters of a lot of things.
Yeah, and the range of skills you would need to do this. I mean, you mentioned chemicals. You said vertical extraction. I presume that's people who've fallen off cliffs and such like. Is that right?
Yeah, very much so. We rescue people. So, you know, Ginninderra Falls is a notorious one for having to rescue people out of there. There's a reason it's closed. Yeah. And yet people still seem to find their way in there, and we do tend to do a lot of rescues out of there.
Well, many of our listeners will remember in great clarity the bushfires of 2003, thank you, and I will remember that myself. And there was even, I live in Belconnen, and there were no, the fire front was in the south end, but there were some houses that went up in sort of unrelated incidents. But to see the sky go black, we were at Questacon, in fact, on that day, and I looked up at the sky, and it was a bright, sunny day, and then there was this great black cloud, and what Canberrans went through, and of course, it must have been a hellish day for the fire service. Were you in Canberra at that time?
I was in Canberra. I wasn't actually in the fire service at that time, so I did live in Western Creek, so the things you're talking about I experienced, but not as a professional firefighter at the time.
It's kind of a worst case situation because it's not just an isolated event, it's the whole city that was under threat.
Yeah, unfortunately, the way the world is going, you know, we have this climate change, we have a lot hotter, and these sorts of events are happening, you know, yearly now. You know, we think of Black Saturday, that was 3 years ago. Tasmania's on fire now. We never thought that would have happened. I think this is going to become our norm, and I think Canberra, it's only a matter of time until this starts to happen again.
Yeah. It's a worrying trend. Now, what happens in a fire? Just walk me through. So I guess there's lots of different fire situations. So maybe we can start off by classifying the types of fire, and then let's talk a bit about what the elements, what the key elements of a fire. So I presume we've got a bushfire. There's different sorts of bushfire. Would that be right?
As a general rule, we have grass fires, we have more traditional bushfires once it does get up into those trees. As I said, I'm a professional urban firefighter, so bushfire is not really my thing. But you know, in my world, we work from the range of a fire in a bin right up to a multi-story, multi-agency fire, such as the Diamond Hotel or even the Sydney Building Fire, which was a couple of years ago. The size and scale is somewhat irrelevant in that the fire still behaves the way it behaves. It's just the environment that it's put in will change.
Do you have some kind of classification system? So you're on call, and your workmates are on call, and then you get an alarm saying, you know, there's an event somewhere. Do you have some sort of classification to say this is the sort of situation we're about to go into?
Yeah, we have what we call business rules, which will dictate. So, and that'll depend on things like the loading. So a standard house fire in Canberra would generally generate two urban pumpers. But again, depending on the information we get, that could be three. We could send four. We could send one. So a lot of it comes down to actually knowing our business and responding. Whereas something the size of, say, Mitchell, you know, we throw everything we have at that. Unfortunately, we're very limited in the resources we have in Canberra. We have 9 fire stations. You look at the big fires in Sydney and they'll throw 20, 30 fire trucks at a job if it's needed.
So I presume the worst case scenario, the chemical fire in Mitchell was pretty bad, and then there'd also be high-rise buildings. I imagine that must be a pretty worrying scenario.
Yeah, and it is what it is, and you know, we will respond with what we have. We're lucky now that a lot of the good work that's been done by fire services, particularly with sprinklers and alarm systems, have actually made it somewhat safer.
Oh, okay.
As we go along, but
So prevention is obviously. So, what are the key elements in a fire? So, you've got what happens in a fire? Okay, let's say a typical house fire.
So we talk about what we call the fire triangle. So there's three things that are needed for a fire to occur. We have oxygen, we have heat, and we also have fuel. And at any given time, any of those variables can change, and that will change the behaviour of the fire. So we think if we have a fire in a sealed room with minimal air, that will smoulder for a long, long time, and it may not actually develop into a full-blown fire. When you then add oxygen to that environment, so one of our guys opens a door, or in your house you open a door and add oxygen to that, all of a sudden what you've done is you've given it what it needs to then start to really take off.
Yes, I remember there was a Hollywood movie called Fire, maybe you can remember, but I think what I remember from that was you put your hand on the door, is that right? So if you were in a house and there was a fire in one room and there was a door between you and the fire, what would you recommend? I mean, and I'm assuming you'd say the first thing is leave the house. But say there's an urgent reason to go through, you have a good reason to go into that room, or maybe you think you can want to assess the fire. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but tell me, what should I do?
Well, I mean, if there is an issue where you think there may be a fire behind a door, heat travels through conduction, so it will travel through the door. So if you put your hand on the door and it's hot, it's a pretty good indicator there's a fire on the other side of it, if that's what you're looking for. We don't recommend people put fires out. Get on the phone, 000, there's a fire truck less than 10 minutes away who can come and deal with that for you. Because as I said, what you could do is by opening that door, you can actually make something it's a savable situation, make that incredibly dangerous.
So you might be better just to deprive it of oxygen and leave the door shut?
Very much so, and that's what we always advise. If you're in an area and you can't close the door, you'll take the oxygen away from it and potentially stop the spread of that fire or the fire itself.
Okay, so now you're in the house, you've done the right thing, you've put your hand on the door, no, it's hot in there, I'm going to leave the house, but the house is filling up with smoke. Do you get down and crawl out of the house, or do you put a wet blanket over you? How should you respond? I mean, what's the best way to get out of a house as safely as you can possibly do?
When we educate our kindergarten kids, every third term every year, every fire truck is in all the primary schools in Canberra, we tell them to get down low and go, go, go. Smoke, what will happen is as a fire develops, the smoke and the heat will rise to the roof, mm-hmm. or the ceiling, sorry, and then that ceiling, as it gets hotter and hotter, that heat will start to come down. So the lower you are out of that smoke, we call that the neutral plane where that smoke is, you crawl out. We go into house fires and you won't see, it's not like the movies where you see them walking around. If we're going inside, we'll be down very low on our knees, crawling around trying to find what we're looking for in that heat.
Right. So here on Fuzzy Logic, we're talking fire and other hazardous situations, heat. We're going to get more onto the heat stress response in the body, and a little bit more later on PTSD and what happens to people in those sort of situations. Now, Anthony, when you come to the outside of a building, so you've, what's the first thing you do as a fire crew? Do you say the house is burning?
First thing we do, we're sizing up the environment. We talk about managing risk. It's not like in the movies where we go through kicking the front doors. We are trying to manage a risk. So we're looking for a range of things, and modern houses have things like solar panels on the roof. We have power coming in. It's underground now, whereas it used to be on the walls. So we're looking at what are the hazards that could actually get us hurt in that environment. We're then weighing up what are the risks and what are the benefits of that. So very much to the point where if there are people in the house, we're probably more likely to sustain or take higher levels of risk than we would if there was no one in that house.
So your priority is to save life, of course, yeah.
Yeah, very much so. And again, whilst there is potential, there are days we just will not go into a house. If that's the case, if the risk is too high for our firefighters, then unfortunately we will not go in. But if there is someone in that house, we are prepared to sustain a higher level of risk at any given time.
It's a frightening thought. Now, how much time have you got? So if a fire is well established in a house, how long has that house got? What's the prospect for that house?
Modern houses, so what we call a flashover. So essentially a flashover is when everything in the room will combust. As I said, the heat. What will happen is you'll have the heat starting in a corner. That will then get the smoke as it rises to the ceiling. The smoke will then start to heat up. The smoke will actually then catch fire. And when that gets to a certain temperature of about 800 to 900 degrees at the ceiling, what will happen is that whole room will then catch fire through radiant heat, through conduction, through convection. And in the modern world, given our houses are full of plastics, full of foams, full of all those sorts of essentially chemicals that are based on petroleum product, that can be a 3 to 4 minute prospect. Traditional houses, which were wood, natural materials, that could have been 30 or 40 minutes. So what we're seeing now is a lot of houses, we cannot get to those before it's gone through the ceiling and through the roof.
Oh, okay. So the first thing is you get the initial fire, you get the substances in the room heating up, they're going to emit the gas. And I remember now the name of that movie, it was Flashback.
Or Backdraft.
Backdraft.
That's
Thank
it.
You. Thank you. Backdraft, not Flashback. But in that, they had a scene where somebody opens the door and there's this great shoot of flame that comes out because, like you're saying, oxygen has got in, the gases are all of the vaporized material of the stuff in the room. And then, so does the fire then get into the... Does it travel through the ceiling cavity mostly? Is that how it gets from one room to the next? What's the usual progression from there?
Again, fire, unfortunately, there is no usual progression, but once it does punch through that ceiling and it's into the roof space, then it will start to roll around within that roof space. From my own background, it tends to be where we have things like the clip-lock roofs now and the galvanised roofs. They tend to trap the heat in a lot more and it tends to roll around. But above you, you've got timber. So as that catches fire, eventually that will fail and the tiles will fall in. And then we'll see the spectacular fires we see when the flames go up through the roof.
So I think you were saying before we went on today that a house will go really quickly. It's like... It's not long at all before a house is going to be destroyed. Is that...
Unfortunately, that's the case now.
Yeah.
The way houses are built now. A lot of our houses, the traditional way that builders used to build houses are moving away to things like trusses where they're machined and they're held together with staples and bolts. We have suspended roofs using I-beams that are made of laminated timber, which will fail under heat and under water. So the risk to firefighters is actually increasing dramatically as we go along.
Well, now I did have a conversation with a firey a while back, and he told me that he had a stovetop fire, and he looked a bit a bit embarrassed. He said, I'd attended a fire in someone, kitchen, and he said then I went and left something on the stove. How do most fires start in a house?
Pretty much the kitchen.
Kitchen?
Kitchens are a fairly dangerous place, as you said. It's hot. Another campaign we ran a couple of years ago was the Don't Stop Looking While You're Cooking.
That's what he did. He walked off and left a pot on, the thing went. And now I'm just going to quickly tell an embarrassing Rod story here, because I managed to set fire to my motorbike once, and I was 5-10 kilometres out of Bombala, and would you believe, of all people, standing at the roadworks was a road worker, and he had a fire extinguisher. But I can remember seeing the flames shoot off my motorbike and just thinking, I am so screwed. It was an awful feeling. And then this guy ran over with a little fire extinguisher and he put it out. So after that, I thought, I don't want that in my house. It was bad enough seeing my bike, which, by the way, survived, minus a bit of superficial damage. I went and bought a fire extinguisher for my home and a fire blanket. Was that a good thing to do, Anthony? To give you a leading question, perhaps? What sort of preparation would you recommend that we do at home, apart from...
The most important thing that you need in your house is you need smoke alarms, and they need to be working. There's no point putting them up there and then forgetting about them for five years. They will alert you to the fact that fire, when it starts in that smouldering stage where we're getting that level of smoke coming up, it may alert you to the fact you can go and put that fire out and save your house. More importantly, when we're asleep, you will not wake, the human body won't wake up to smoke. So if you have the smoke alarm, that will wake you from your sleep and it will allow you to get out of the house and get out safely. Unfortunately, whenever we see fatalities in houses, a lot of those are related to the fact that people did not have a smoke alarm in that house. That is the most important thing you can put in your house. Fire blankets, definitely worth having in the kitchen. As you said, if for some reason your cooking is not, your cooking skills aren't real flash and you catch things on fire, a fire blanket will snuff that out. Remember we talked about the fire triangle, and by putting a fire blanket over a pot, what you've done is you've taken the oxygen away and you put the fire out.
Yes, you actually remind me of something from my teenage years. Now, my sister had a little pot sitting on a burner and she was doing batik. I think it was, you know, you put the wax on the textile and so on. And we came into the room and found this thing shooting flame. And there was probably like a meter high flame coming off the top of this thing. Now, we could have just left it because it was sitting safely on this thing. And Dad and I did the worst, actually probably the second worst possible thing, I think you might say. We would try to blow it out.
Yeah.
And what happened? It went.
So you're adding air to the environment. Yep. Again, you're adding oxygen is like fuel. It does the same thing.
Now I imagine the second worst, or probably actually that was the second worst thing. I imagine the worst on top of that would have been to pour water onto it.
If it's an oil fire, very much so. You hit oil with water, and you know, they don't mix, and it will actually make it worse. And it can actually vaporize the air, vaporize into the air, and basically explode in your face if you add water to something with the oil in it.
Oh, nasty! And then the oil in the water that's there is going to spread across the floor, and you're really in trouble now.
Yeah. So you've gone from a contained fire in a pot to now all of a sudden your whole kitchen's on fire. The reason that professionals are so good at their job is it is about being calm. It's about slow and deliberate. When people grab that pot and move it, you just start to change your environment, where just throwing a fire blanket over the top may just snuff that out, and then you're fine.
Yeah, well, at least we didn't do that. And then I think we did a couple of puffs onto this thing, and then, like, duh, see a great shot of flame leaping out of this pot. All right, bad move. So we realized that was a losing streak. So what we did is we got an old shirt and we dropped it over the top and it smothered the fire. And within, the thing ballooned for a few moments. I remember seeing the flame under this thing trying to, balloon out of the pot. But then after a few moments, the thing was deprived itself of oxygen, and then it went out, and the crisis was over. But that could have been really, really nasty.
Yeah, you need to think of fire as a living creature. It seeks oxygen, same as we do. If it doesn't have oxygen, it doesn't survive. So again, going back to your Hollywood backdraft, if you think about it, the puffing of smoke underneath the door, it's an indicator for us that there's a backdraft, which is an incredibly dangerous situation for us. But what it's doing is it's actually seeking air from wherever it can be. So if you can isolate that air and stop the supply, you can quite easily put a fire out.
Okay, so some sage warning there for you here on Fuzzy Logic Science Show. We're talking to Dr. Anthony Walker, who is a thermal physiologist dealing with people who are under heat stress, from the University of Canberra, and he's a firefighter. One of those guys that you call on when you ring 00 because you left the pot on too long. Don't do that. And my mate Jimi Hendrix, he's dropped into the studio and he's got a song for us, which is pretty relevant today. Yeah.
pigeons coughed and changed the subject and said, "All right, I think it might snow some." So I left him sipping his tea, and I jumped in my chair and run off to see just why and who could it be this time. Sisters and brothers, daddies, mothers standing around crying. When I reached the scene, the flames were making a ghostly whine. So I stood on my horse's back, and I screamed without a breath. I say, "Oh, baby, why did you burn your brother's house down?" Disgusted, so we paint red through the sky. I say the truth is straight ahead, so don't burn yourself instead. Try to learn instead of burn, hear what I say. So I turned and rode away, but I'll never forget that day. Cause when I reached the valley, I looked way down across the way. A giant boat from space landed with eerie grace and came and taken all the dead away.
A bit of classic Jimi Hendrix there with that guitar whining and screaming, house burning down here on Fuzzy Logic Science Show, and our guest Dr. Anthony Walker, who's a thermal physiologist at the University of Canberra and from the ACT Fire Service. Now, Anthony, we're talking about the fire and what happens to people who are around the fires, especially the fire crew. What's happening to a firefighter's body as they're in this situation?
Okay, so what will generally affect how people create heat in their body? So our bodies are an incredibly inefficient machine in that when you exercise, we produce heat. We call that metabolic heat production. And what happens is, as you can imagine, our firefighters, particularly modern firefighters, wear a lot of gear. So before they even grab a tool, grab a hose, they're wearing about 23 kilograms of gear.
So 23 kilos. So imagine that's 23 milk cartons.
Yes. So our gear, as I said, that includes heavy boots. So the boots have to have steel plates in them. They have to have steel caps so that we don't get impact or penetration. We then have our overclothes. So people in Canberra will understand that our guys wear bright yellow because of their yellow fire trucks. But that gear, we also have a big structural helmet. And then what we do is we put on our back what we call a self-contained breathing apparatus, which we just refer to as a BA set. And so when you combine all those things together, it's 23 kilo. And then by then, you then start to grab hoses, you grab whatever. And we can be walking around with 40 or 50 kilos worth of gear at any given time.
Wow. Well, dear Fuzzy listener, your presenter here today, he weighs a massive 65 kilos. So that's half of Rod that you're carrying around.
Yeah, and that's before we even go anywhere near a fire. As I said previously, our modern gear, for a long time there, our firefighters suffered a lot of steam burns. So one way of fixing that is we put within our PPE, we have a Gore-Tex membrane there, which is great in that it stops that steam coming into our gear.
Oh, so just to clarify, so steam, so you're pouring water onto a fire and that's generating steam. Is that what's happening?
Yeah. Okay. And then, you know, it's superheated and it will go through normal clothing. So our modern gear is designed to protect us from that and also from chemicals. So we know the environment we work in is highly toxic. It causes issues for us with cancer and all sorts of stuff down the track. But strictly from a heat perspective, the problem then is we've essentially encapsulated our people in a plastic bag, which means that they can't dissipate heat in any way other than when they can get that gear off, which unfortunately, you know, you can't do that most of the time just because of the nature of the gear and the environment.
So you seem to have like almost the perfect storm here. You've got, you're physically active, you're carrying a lot of gear, you're wearing heavy insulating clothing, you're near a heat source, it could be a hot day. This is pretty serious. Now, is hyperthermia, excessive body heat, is a life-threatening situation, is it not?
Yeah, very much so. And we're currently in a process of trying to educate our firefighters. So for a long time, we bought into the mythology that, you know, we're hard men and that, you know, you're going to get hot and you need to tough it out and suck it up. We're trying to change our mindset there and start to, for example, we wouldn't tolerate the heat in our athletes. So the Australian Open, you know, it's 38 degrees and the tennis players are starting to struggle in the heat. That's our environment every day. So our people are always working in those environments. So we can then move into this hypothermic situation where if our people aren't seeing the initial, they're not detecting that they are actually hot or they're not watching what's going on, they can then move into what we call heat stroke. And heat stroke can be fatal. It's a neurocognitive issue as well in that your brain will essentially cook itself and you won't be able to function.
I remember Dad telling me he was in the Korean War and he said they had an enemy contact and his friend collapsed afterwards and they thought he was under stress from the contact, you know, the fright, as it were, and so they wrapped him in a blanket and it turned out that he was actually suffering from hyperthermia and he died as a result. So how hot can your body get before, you know, it's going to kill you?
As a general rule, our bodies like to operate around 37-odd degrees. That's where we like to be. At any given time in any different population, you and me both might have a different resting rate. When we start to get above about 40 degrees, your core, so your deep body temperatures, then we start to have issues. Once we get up to around 41, 42, that's when we start to move into those incredibly dangerous situations where people die.
Do you know why the term is stroke, heat stroke, or is it just as in you're struck by heat?
I have no idea. Yeah, maybe it's just it sounds worse, I guess.
I make it my objective to ask every interviewee a question they can't answer, so we've got to tick that one off. Okay, so your body is hot. Now, just another quick anecdote. I remember being on parade because I did a short stint in the army myself, and the guy next to me fainted. But I really remember seeing the pores on his face sticking out, and he was white as a sheet. What was going on?
Yeah, so as I said, the main way your body will dissipate heat into the environment is through evaporation of sweat. Unfortunately, your body only has a certain amount of sweat that it can deliver. And if you're starting a day where you may already be naturally dehydrated, you only have a certain amount to give. And what will happen is over time, you'll just stop being able to sweat. As I said, that's your main mechanism of cooling. And then once you can't now cool, your core temperature will rise rapidly and quickly. The other thing as well, what will happen is your blood pressure will drop. So your diastolic blood pressure will drop through the floor, which means you start to feel faint.
So that's why he was white.
Probably, yeah.
He went pale.
Yeah. So what's happening is as your body will dissipate heat, so we have vasodilation, which is essentially as you get hot, your body will send blood to the periphery, so out to your skin, and your veins will actually just open up, so they'll become wider, so that we can get out to get the heat and to get it back into the core, so the cooler air. What that does, though, as you can imagine, if you're pouring the same amount of pressure down a bigger pipe than the smaller one, we now have a lower pressure. So if you're naturally at a low blood pressure, it can get to a point where you will just feel faint, and your body wants to put you on the deck to try and correct that.
Okay, now, dear listener, you can read Dr. Walker's response to our question about heat stress in the Canberra Times, which was a week ago, and it's about what happens when you get heat stress, and you can read it online at the Canberra Times Fairfax website. And also you can ask your own questions to an expert by sending an email to askfuzzy@zoho.com. Now, Anthony, you've done research into this. What was that about?
So what we did, my PhD, we essentially tried to answer three questions with our firefighters. We wanted to know what happens. So how hot do they get? Why do they get hot? And then more importantly, how do we put them back together and stop them getting hot in the first place? Mm-hmm. To some extent, we signed up for it. We knew that there was fire. We knew that we signed up for heat. But what we want to do is we want to understand what are the mechanisms and how that's going to affect their body. So we wanted to know about performance characteristics. So when we're hot, we wanted to know how does that impact on your strength? How does that impact on your performance? How does that impact on your cognitive abilities? Because we know that as we get tired, we start to make bad choices as we get hotter. So what we wanted to do, we wanted to know that. So we did that through... So the Emergency Services Agency has a hot cell training facility out at Hume. And for the essential protocol we ran was we had it running at about 100 degrees. And we had the guys and girls from Fire Rescue in that for 20 minutes. Then they came out for a 10-minute recovery. And then they went back in for another 20 minutes. So what that told us was we learnt what the profile of the heat was and when those rapid changes happened. But then what we also then did after that, we then went through some cooling protocols. So we started to think, what's happening in the athletic world and what can we bring to the occupational space?
Okay, so you're developing, or this, you've used this information to develop guidelines for how the field behaves how the crew behaves in the field in a fire situation.
Yeah, so we want to know, is it safe to send people in 4, 5, 6 BA cylinders in a row? The Sydney building fire, that's what happened. Is it safe? Well, no, we know that now, but we need the understanding of what it is and why that is. So we know for our people that as they get hot, their strength starts to deteriorate. So they can't actually physically do the job they want to do. Their gait, so their ability to walk in a straight line and not trip over things, rapidly plummets. So we're increasing the risk of them falling over as a general sort of thing. So we're looking at informing protocols, but also how we then cool them after that, because we don't just go to one job in a day. It's a 10-hour or a 14-hour shift, and if we can't look after people after that first shift, how can we then expect them to perform again and again and again?
So you have a duty of care to the firefighters, as well as having them be as effective as possible. That must be pretty challenging, because in a fire situation, people put on the emergency response mode, and I've seen motorcyclists, you know, continue riding a race with a broken ankle inside a boot, and they sort of shut the pain down. They shut off the signals, and so their self protection mechanism, they push it aside. Is that the sort of thing that you see?
Our guys aren't that tough. They look tough, but they're not really. Neither are the girls. They will be motivated depending upon what's going on. So again, right. if they're having to go in and rescue a kid in a burning building, that motivation will allow them to push through that heat. If they're doing something else, their threshold for what that heat, where they're prepared to continue to work for, will drop quite dramatically. So motivation is a big issue for how hot they're prepared to get before their performance starts to drop.
Oh, actually, you make me think that most of us, when we see an emergency situation, go into emergency response mode. But I would guess that a firefighter, their level of training is such that I guess they're not so surprised by what they see. So they would behave a bit more calmly, a bit more rationally. Is that so? The preparation, the training is critical for them.
As a general rule, that's the case. What we see is particularly our younger firefighters, so the guys and girls when they first start. So we'll have a recruit college come out later this year. They'll tend to run at everything like a bull at a gate. They go fast, they go hard, because they don't have that awareness and that knowledge. So you'll see older firefighters who they'll move slower, but they'll still achieve the outcome. So they learn to pace, they learn to work out how to do it. You think back to a game of football, the greatest footballers are the ones who look like they're in slow motion, because they just get that innate ability to read what's going on and then react in the appropriate way.
Yes, you kind of remind me of a slightly inappropriate joke, but it's the old bull and the young bull walking across the top of the hill, and they see down the paddock a collection of very saucy heifers, and the young bull says, "Let's go down and get ourselves a heifer," and the old bull says, "No, let's go down slowly and get the whole herd."
And that's exactly how our guys think. So you can't buy experience. You can train people as much as you like, but until they've actually started to get that experience over time...
Well, here on Fuzzy Logic, we are talking about hot situations, dangerous situations, and people who put their lives on the line. I mean, they take their job, they take measured risks. They're very careful what they do. Our guest today is Dr. Anthony Walker from the University of Canberra and the ACT Urban Fire Service. We might break to a quick track, and when we come back, Anthony, let's talk about what happens to a person post fire, because it doesn't just in once the fire is out. Oh, a bit of classic Led Zeppelin here on Fuzzy Logic, under the cover of the ice and snow in the midnight sun where the hot springs flow. I think that's how it goes if you were listening to the lyrics. And that's the cold, but we've been talking about hot here today on Fuzzy Logic with our guest, Dr. Anthony Walker, who's a thermal physiologist, try saying that after a beer, at the University of Canberra and the ACT Fire Service. Now, Anthony, as we were saying before we went to the break, you've got the situation before the fire, the training, the stuff that you do when you get to the fire, and then you've got this situation, what happens after the fire? And I'm talking now about the fire crew, the people themselves. What are the long-term impacts? How much do we know about the long-term impacts of people exposed to these situations?
Okay, so what we see now in our firefighters, which we traditionally haven't done a great deal of work with, most of our focus has been on actually putting the fire out, throwing technology at it, and we're starting to become aware of there's a lot of changes going on with our people. Elevated core temperatures, what they result in is they result in what we changes in your immune system, and also changes through inflammation. So the simplest example of that is firefighters in the modern world don't die in fires anymore. The Americans lose about 100 firefighters a year fatalities, and of those, 50 to 60% of those are heart attacks. So people have been throwing a lot of effort at trying to work out what this is, and a lot of it is to do with body conditioning, with an aging workforce, and this is what's happening in the world.
Oh, so just quickly, heart attacks, you're talking about heart attacks not on the day, but heart attacks sometime later?
Or both? We see heart attacks at the fire ground, we see heart attacks when they go home. What's happening is, and it's taken a long time for us to work out what this is, but essentially when you have an immune response, so when you get hot, things leave your stomach. So we have your stomach's an incredibly toxic environment, and that then will flood into your system. Your body will detect an inflammation and an infection, and will react in that way and attack that. So what we have is we have both your white blood cells, which are your killer blood cells that go out and try and attack things, but we also have platelets aggregating. So platelets are a clotting agent within your body for when you're injured. So what will happen is we see a lot more of those kicking around in the body, and they will try to localize an infection to a part of your body. Now what's happening is we know that we see a really marked acute response to that. So we see these platelets and white blood cells, but we know from the research that we looked at that 24 hours later is still elevated. So you have a higher risk of heart attack. So they'll go home, they'll go to bed, they haven't cooled down properly, these will still be kicking along, and then they just won't wake up. And we see that a lot in US firefighters now.
Okay, so this is a stress response. So I'm guessing that a person in a physically or any stressful situation, that the body is preparing for damage. So that's why the platelets are activated, and possibly associated infection, because they're like there's some physical damage to the bottom. So your body is preparing to deal with that. Is that like a reasonable?
Pretty much. Theory? We have what we call it's a net. It's a neutrophil extracellular trap, and basically what it does, it will try and localize an infection to a part of your body. So it will create a clot out in, say, for an example, it might catch it in your arm, and that clot will stay there. Now that's fine, and over time it'll just break down and go away. But you think if that clot then moves into a part of your body, so into your heart. So if you already have a population of older firefighters who may be hypertensive, so they've got, you know, plaque in their arteries, all that sort of stuff, if all of a sudden a clot then appears in there, what it can do is it can actually just create a blockage in those arteries and veins, or it can move into your brain and we have a stroke. So these are things we're seeing a lot of the time, that it is just knocking firefighters over. They will die at the job as well. You got your firefighters working really hard who may not be in the best physical condition, or just the environment has caused it, and they will just drop dead.
Okay, so apart from keeping your firefighters physically fit, does that mean that you need to also keep the age group younger?
Not so much. I think what we need to do is we need to start to think about how we look after our people. That requires us to think slightly differently in that our work-rest ratio. So it's no longer good enough to send two trucks to a job. Let's send four so that we can give people their time and then pull them back out, recover them and send them back into the workforce where they've been cooled down. So these immune and inflammatory changes are actually being stopped before they go back to work.
So there's a post-event wind down, so on. And is there, what's the psychological component here? Do you have like a debriefing which you've got to get the facts of the event, but also is there a focus of a debriefing towards the mental state of the crews?
Very much so. Modern firefighters, and it's the same with police, ambulance, nurses. We have high rates of PTSD and depression in our populations. We see a lot of horrible stuff. There's no doubt about it. But what's happening is a lot of the time is we're starting to see a bit of a disconnect between the amount of things we see and the actual rates of depression. So when we did pull we pulled some blood out of our guys when we did the testing, and girls, and what we saw is we saw marked increases post heat exposure in markers that we see in depressed patients in the general population. So what we're seeing is a possible link there, which at the moment, this may be just my theory, but at the moment we haven't addressed that. So we focus very carefully on the critical incident. So the actual, your feelings and how you're mentally treating those sorts of things. Whereas when we have our people hot, we look like we're pre-priming them for these sorts of events. So they're in a state where they're already predisposed to it, and a lot of that could be the fact that they are hot, we haven't looked after them. Then they then deal with an acute traumatic event, so they go to a car crash, they go to a suicide, all those sorts of things we address, that may be just enough to tip them over the edge.
Okay, so just let me understand this. So I think with something like post-traumatic stress, there's the psychological component, but I think you're also saying there's a physical component that can prime a person for post-traumatic stress. Is that what you're thinking?
That's what sort of seems to be coming out of the new research coming out from a lot of labs around the world. We know that these links already exist, so we had one side of the equation, but we didn't have the link between those occupational exposures. So, we have high levels of military PTSD, but when we think traditionally about where our last few wars have been, Vietnam, Korea, Afghanistan, Iraq, they're in hot environments where people are likely to be predisposed, so they're hot all the time. Access to limited cooling. Your modern soldiers wear ridiculous amounts of body armour, helmets, the amount of gear they're producing and carrying is going to then increase these sorts of things. Then all of a sudden they then experience an acute traumatic event, so someone shooting at them, or just the concept that someone's going to blow you up would be enough to then possibly then trip you over the edge.
Yes. So what can we do about it? Is there a treatment, prevention
And that's the million-dollar question. All our focus in the world has been on how we, you know, it's the psychology of it. And psychology plays a part, but if we had a handle, we would have solved this problem. But yet we continue to see high rates of these in the population. So we need to start to think a bit differently and start to address, well, if the occupational exposures, so working in the heat, working with dust, sleep deprivation, all these things create inflammatory changes, can we address those in the workplace to try and then offset the pre-priming effect as we go?
Yes, it's a terrible thought to, you know, we expose people, we put them in these sort of situations and they come back damaged. Like in a war situation, that's altogether different, because I guess in a fire, usually you can withdraw and you can say the fire, you know, just try and contain the fire. But in a war situation, it's going to be much more difficult. So now, why is it that heat more than cold? I mean, cold seems to be much less dangerous to the human body than heat does.
I think it's purely because our body has to do a lot of things to get rid of heat. And the more we do, the more we generate. So we get those inflammatory. Whereas as we get cold, we merely start to slow down. Our metabolism will start to just reduce in its speed and intensity.
And is the heat damaging the proteins? Like the brain is particularly susceptible to heat.
That's the problem. It does kick things along. Your body, as I said, likes working around that 37 degrees. That's where it's happy. After you do that, it will start to break things down. As changes happen in your body, it will adapt. And then it has to get things from there. So we call that denatured proteins, as it changes that with that heat. So, you know, think of a steak on the barbecue. Look at what happens to the changes of it, and essentially the human body is like a steak.
Yeah.
So you'll see changes as it gets cooked along.
So do you think there's much that can be done to improve the gear, to make it lighter and to make it breathe better and so on?
I don't think so. I think the gear we have now has been designed for a certain purpose, and it's very good at that. So what we call aggressive internal fire attack, that's what it's for. What we need to do is we need to start to think differently and maybe not wear it for everything. What's the risk? So if I'm doing something, do I necessarily need to be wearing full structural firefighting equipment? Can I be just wearing something a lot lighter and a lot more permeable for that? It's doing our business smarter rather than just ploughing along, because we've always done it that way.
Well, for any of us who've called upon the fire service or any of the emergency services, we should be extremely grateful for the risks that people take and the skill and the expertise with which they throw into helping us out. Because when you're in a crisis, these are the people we need to talk to. So our guest is Dr. Anthony Walker from the University of Canberra and the ACT Fire Service. And one thing which we didn't get much time to discuss, Anthony, was toxicity. And there's all sorts of nasty chemicals. You mentioned the plastics and stuff like that. We ran a Ask Fuzzy column a couple of weeks ago on why cyanide is toxic. And we've got one coming up in a few weeks about how the body deals with toxicity. We have an interesting question on that. So there's chronic and acute, short-term, long-term, things that accumulate, things that don't, long-term, short-term damage when you're exposed to a toxin. Today's Ask Fuzzy is about why your own voice sounds different, which is one I wrote. And if you heard yourself back on recording, Anthony, if you listen to the podcast for today's show, your voice will sound different.
It's always a good thing.
And you'll be able to pick that up off iTunes and Fuzzy Logic on 2xx.podbean.com. You can pick us up there, and you can tweet us, and you can pick us up on that Facebook thing as well. Another reader has written in with a question about what happened to all the Christmas beetles, which is interesting. I can remember swarms around the gum tree around my place at home, but you don't see them all that often. So I have someone from the Australian Museum writing about beetles, and that'll be next week. And there's a few introduced pests, apparently. And I have another reader who's also asked about colour, why are corals colourful when you get down to the deeper waters, when presumably they're not so visible. And so I have a coral expert who is going to help us out with that one. And don't forget, we're at the Multicultural Festival. Let's say g'day to everybody who's out there at the festival today. We've got a tent up near the Canberra Museum and Gallery, and I'm going to trot down there and do my little stint this afternoon. So come down and say g'day to us at the tent for the Multicultural Festival. And of course, Fuzzy Logic and 2XX is very strong on multicultural. We have our multicultural programs running throughout the week. That's a great service to the community. So Anthony, you're going to relax, you're going to get yourself nice and cool this afternoon, unwind. You're not going to jog in the sun, right?
No, not at all. Go early when it's out of the heat of the day, and that's the best way to do it.
And plenty of cold water and maybe a beer to unwind. All right, well, thanks for your company, and we're going to say goodbye now. Plenty more coming up next week. Catch you later.